This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. June is Gay Pride Month, and in Charleston and across the country, parades and festivals celebrate the progress of gay rights. But they also highlight the ongoing struggle against discrimination and hate crimes. The latest episode of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, Us and Them, looks at cultural divides across America and the evolving attitudes on each side. In the episode titled Sodomy, Stonewall, and Pride, host Trey Kay speaks with Charleston resident Bill Richards about living at a time when sodomy was a criminal offense. In 1966, Bill had just left his wife and was starting a new life as a gay man.
Well, about 3 weeks later, I was out at Clendenin working in another little flower shop, helping do a wedding for a friend of mine. And the state police came to the door at the flower shop, and they said they'd like to see William Robert Richards. And so I went out there, and they had a warrant for my arrest for sodomy.
In the mid to late 1960s, West Virginia, like most other states, had laws that considered certain sexual acts to be criminal. These sex acts were deemed to be unnatural or immoral and fell under the catch-all term sodomy. These laws varied greatly from state to state and were usually vague on the specifics that constituted sodomy. Generally, it was understood that sodomy meant oral and anal sex, but only when gay people did these things, not necessarily straight people.
So they gave me the choice of either being prosecuted or going to a Western State Hospital.
If you had been prosecuted, what would that have meant?
Well, I think that the time they said I'd probably spent at least 10 years in prison. 10 to 15 or something like that.
Prior to 1962, sodomy was a felony in every state, punished by a long prison term and possibly hard labor. After 62, most states started to dial down the punishments, but not all did. In Idaho, a conviction could earn a life sentence. Michigan had a maximum sentence of 15 years for first offenders, life for repeat offenders. When Bill was before a judge in 1966, West Virginia still had stiff sentences.
It was enough to scare you and shake you up pretty good. So you think, well, it'd be easier just to go away to the crazy house.
Did you think you were crazy?
No, I knew I wasn't crazy. But I thought I'll just go right on up there rather than go to jail because they, you know, well, I thought I'd be out of there and zip, you know. I didn't know they were going to slam me in maximum security for 3 months, which was just like going to prison, really.
The crazy house that Bill is referring to is the Weston State Mental Hospital. It's an enormous Gothic building that has sections that predate the Civil War. And even though it wasn't a prison, the place has kind of a scary look. It's right out of a horror film. You know, the kind of a place you'd imagine Dr. Frankenstein doing experiments.
There was like four huge dormitories. They're large. I'd take 25 in a dormitory. And those were all people from Moundsville prison, from petty thieves to murderers. Lifers. And for most part, they were very, everybody was good to me.
But so nobody ever mistreated you while you were in maximum security?
No, not me. They didn't. I saw a lot of other people get mistreated. But I was never mistreated by anyone. Not the, oh, I might have got a cat call or two, you know, but never anything serious. If I hadn't have lucked out through Vista Workers and got to meet Dr. Cornelius Wilbur, I could still be there. People wound up spending a lifetime in those places.
Actually, Bill couldn't still be at Weston today because the institution shut down in 1994. Today, the place has reverted to its original name, the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, and is now open to the public as a museum. The new owners stage a lot of paranormal events and all-night ghost tours on the facility grounds. But back when Bill was there, he says that he was helped by VISTA workers. If you don't know what that is, they're volunteers who fight poverty. VISTA is like the Peace Corps, but the volunteers work in the U.S., not overseas. But did you catch that name, Dr. Cornelia Wilbur? The doctor that the VISTA workers introduced Bill to?
They're everywhere. No, you keep them away from me. I will do it.
Back in the 1970s, Sally Field starred in a movie about a woman who'd been diagnosed with multiple personality disorder. Dr. Cornelia Wilbur was the real-life psychologist who worked with the woman known as Sybil.
Sybil? I hate Sybil. I hate her.
Who are you?
And Dr. Wilbur was superintendent at Weston Hospital when Bill was there.
When you mentioned her name, I knew her as being famous. What did you know about her?
I had no clue, except Joe, the VISTA worker, told me that she had a book that she had collaborated with a lot of people on. And actually, Joe brought me the book to read right while I was there in the hospital, which I read, and it had everybody's views on where they had done this psychoanalytic study of homosexuality. But I had no idea that she had done Sybil and all those things at all.
And what was she like? Describe what it was like.
Well, if you ever saw the movie Sybil, Joanne Woodward was her made over. I swear to you, looks and everything. I was just, when that movie came out, I thought, how in the world could anybody look so much like her and move so much like her?
Yeah, you asked your father about seeing me. What happened? What did he say? Sybil?
I talked to her many times. I almost had open door access to her because I turned a lot of things in that were going on at the facilities, wrong things. And so I almost had open door policy with her. And so she would let me go out to where the VISTA workers lived for cookouts and things, which I was lucky about that, that she would give me a pass to be out for 4 hours or something like that in the evenings. But she made you feel so very good, She just, I can't explain just how to go sit down and talk with somebody that's that intelligent and that can tell you about yourself, who you are and where you are, and then you sit back and realize that, she's telling you the really truth that you've been trying to kick out of your head.
So everybody had been telling you, your mother and everybody else, that you're gay, it's wrong, it's a sin.
Yeah.
You need to go to some place to kind of work out this yeah. pathology that's within you. And Dr. Wilbur said something different.
Oh, no, Dr. Wilbur said from day one, she said, I truly believe that you are born a homosexual. And she is the woman that convinced my mother that to be gay was normal for me. After that, my mother never sent another Billy Graham clipping, never did another thing. She was fine. It was just like the preacher had told her or something, because that was her. And from then on, there was never a problem. And, I had lovers, and she was totally accepting. And, I had a black lover, and you would have thought would never work. Took him home all the time. My brother-in-law once said, she invited us up for Thanksgiving. My brother-in-law said, I'm not going to eat at a table with a nigger. And my mother said, well, I guess you won't be having dinner, will you? So, it changed her whole aspect on everything. And my last lover I had, we were together 15 years, and my mother loved him so much, and she insisted he be in her obituary, even though we had split up, and he certainly was in her obituary.
Wow. Basically, you're saying that transformation really was caused by was by Dr. Cornelia?
Absolutely was. There is no other way about it. It was just like day and night.
It was Dr. Wilbur who got Bill released from Weston State Hospital. It took about 6 months, but she told the sheriff that Bill wasn't insane and that they either needed to charge him or let him go.
And they took me back to Summersville, and the sheriff said I was free to go, and they never wanted to see me in Nicholas County again.
To hear the entire episode or any of the Us and Them podcasts, visit usandthempodcast.com. Us and Them is supported in part by a grant from the West Virginia Humanities Council. Hops, the cone-shaped flowers that give beer its bitterness and zest, were once a major crop in the Ohio Valley region. But prohibition and plant disease put an end to that. U.S. hop production is booming these days, but nearly all of it is happening in western states. Now farmers and brewers across the Ohio Valley think the craft beer industry might bring hops farming back to the region. Nicole Irwin reports on what it would take for hops to live up to the hopes.
On a hill behind West Cole's homestead in Hickory, Kentucky, sits a tenth of an acre plot of Mount Hood, a U.S. hop variety that's tolerant to downy mildew.
Yeah, this spot is windy as it could be. If you don't believe me, try folding up a tarp out here. It'll make you lose your religion.
That's important because hops, a once common plant here in the 1800s, fell to natural threats in the environment.
Disease is the main culprit, and it's all fungus-borne, and it's inoculated with moisture and humid conditions. So on this windy knob, I was hoping that wind would alleviate some of the fungus spores.
The dry, cool climate of the Pacific Northwest has made that region the hops capital, but local breweries want local flavor, and Cole wants the business.
Tobacco's what got me into this because of the bad flavor it put in my mouth. I've grown a crop for another man all my life and made another man a gazillionaire, and I'm living like a pauper. I got into this because there ain't no middleman. I'm making the money.
Cole says three breweries want to buy his hops. According to Hop Growers of America, a nonprofit on the West Coast, contracts are the best way to secure success in a saturated market. State hop alliances in the Ohio Valley region say the hop market is wide open here, but futures contracts reduce the risk that come with the costly startup infrastructure and potential hop market volatility.
We tell new growers to stick with the C's. There's three main varieties that start with C: Cascade, Chinook, and Centennial.
That's Kentucky Hop Growers Alliance spokesperson Scott Eidson.
Hops are very labor intensive and cost prohibitive. So there is a lot of money to be made, but that money is maybe 5-10 years down the road.
Eidson says the largest farm in Kentucky is 5 acres. While that may seem small, the investment cost is huge. So groups like the Kentucky Hop Alliance and West Virginia State University are using grants to purchase equipment. These co-op equipment shares are in spirit with the craft beer appeal, a sort of locavore renaissance. At the second annual Pabuka Beer Fest in Paducah, Kentucky, craft breweries from the region are showcasing their latest tap specials. Lexington-based West 6 Brewing co-owner Joe Kuzman was there.
And it's part of our story, right? As a local brewery, we're asking people to support the local brewery. If we're not supporting our local farmer, then that story we're trying to tell just isn't real.
Kuzman says craft beer is an evolution of the local food movement. People want to know where their beer ingredients come from, just like their food.
And really having their purchases go back to supporting their local community. It's still very old school in that respect, where it's a relationship business.
Craft beer palates change about as often as the season. And with significant hop varieties to choose from, that can create a volatile market for farmers who are working with plants that can take up to 2 years to establish themselves.
A certain variety comes very popular this year. Something new comes out next year, and that old variety just isn't as popular anymore.
Aromatic citrusy hops are in high demand now. Who knows about tomorrow? That's why proprietary varieties like Michigan's Warrior Hops do so well. The variety is owned by the State Alliance, so it can control the supply. That's where the Kentucky Hop Growers Alliance sees stability in creating its own variety, like a Kentucky Gold or Bluegrass proprietary hop. Whatever happens with the hop industry, the process has got to be better than tobacco, says Wes Cole.
It's hard to fight and skin cancer and copperheads for a crop that another man's going to make a fortune off of. It's like a liberation project.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Nicole Irwin in Hickory, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, Marshall University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. I'm Teresa Wills.